Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Under Cover of Darkness by James Grippando, narrated by Richard Poe, and including an interview with the author. This work is copyrighted 2000 by James Grippando. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books. James Grippando is a best-selling author whose books are enjoyed worldwide in more than a dozen languages. Prior to his career as a professional writer, he spent 12 years as a trial lawyer. A few weeks before the publication of his latest thriller, Mr. Grippando paid a visit to the New York studios of Recorded Books to talk a while about his life as both a lawyer and a writer. You will find that interview at the end of the program. Set in Seattle, Under Cover of Darkness is the story of Gus Wheatley, the youngest lawyer ever to be elected managing partner of the city's most prominent law firm. He will allow nothing to stand in the way of his meteoric rise to the top, until his wife vanishes and a serial killer makes an appearance, striking victims in pairs. And now, Under Cover of Darkness.
Prologue. The noose was prepared with exceptional care. Too large a knot, poorly placed, could gouge chunks of flesh from the face and neck. Too much line with a drop too far could mean decapitation. A rope around the neck left little room for error. He tied the loop in a simple slipknot, rather than the classic noose. The classic version was for swift executions, where the long knot of coiled rope would snap against the back of the head, knocking the victim unconscious like a blow from a blackjack. The cervical vertebrae would crack. Bone fragments would crush the spinal cord, bringing on paralysis and, in theory, a painless death. In theory. For centuries, witnesses have said it was never truly painless. They've told of grimacing faces, bodies thrashing violently at the end of the rope, lungs wheezing in futile gasps for air. It was merely a reflex, some contended, like the proverbial headless chicken scampering around the barnyard. Others insisted the pain was real, even in a clean hanging. This afternoon, the old debate was irrelevant. This wasn't supposed to be a clean one. That wasn't his plan. The yellow synthetic rope was 8 feet long and 3/4 inch thick. He'd stolen it from a construction site about a mile from his house. Cutting it was almost like sawing through steel cable. Rope this strong could pull 5 or 6 water skiers at a time, or yank tree stumps from the ground, roots and all. It could surely suspend the weight of a 15-year-old boy. He climbed the stepladder with the rope in hand, nearly tripping on the frayed cuff of his pants leg. The baggy jeans and cotton turtleneck sweatshirt were a daily uniform. He was by far the smartest in his sophomore class, yet his grades were average, and he looked like almost every other boy at school. Thin and gangly. Feet so big he was shaped like an L. Scattered pimples marked the onset of puberty. A few precious facial hairs formed a semblance of a mustache. He peered out the foggy garage window. A thermometer mounted on the window frame said 49 degrees, warm for the dead of winter, but somehow the garage seemed colder than the outdoors. His gaze drifted up toward the rafters, fixing on a steel pulley bolted to the pine. Gently, he tossed up the rope and looped it around the pulley. 2 4-foot lengths dangled from above, draped like pigtails over his simple apparatus. The noose was at one end. The other end was frayed and unknotted. He gave it a tug. The pulley creaked, and the noose rose slowly. All was in working order. He drew a deep breath and placed the noose around his neck. The surroundings immediately assaulted his senses. He was suddenly aware of everything around him, as if the rope were talismanic. The rain tapped rhythmically on the old roof and garage door. A fluorescent light hummed near the workbench along the wall. Oil stains from his father's junky old Buick dotted the cracked cement floor. The stepladder had raised him less than 2 feet above the floor, but it seemed much higher. He was reminded of the bungee jumpers he'd seen on one of those thrill-seeker shows on television. Their ankles tethered by a long elastic band, their eyes burning with excitement as they dove off some bridge and into the canyon. "Let him try this," he thought. He unfurled the cotton turtleneck and flattened the collar all the way up to his chin. The protective fabric had to be tucked beneath the noose all the way around so that no part of the rope touched the soft skin of his neck. Bruises were inevitable, but he had learned to prevent rope burns. He cinched up the slipknot, drawing it tightly around his neck. His feet instantly felt lighter, though they were still planted firmly on the stepladder. With each swallow, the rope pressed against the Adam's apple. He licked his lips and grasped the unknotted end of the rope with both hands. Slowly, he pulled. The pulley creaked. The slack disappeared. The noose gripped his neck and tilted his head back. His heels left the platform. He was standing on his tiptoes. Another pull. He heard himself groan. His vision blurred. His groaning turned to wheezing. He pulled again and again, hand over fist. His toes instinctively reached for the floor, but safety was out of reach. He was in midair, hanging by the neck. "We have liftoff." His grip tightened. His legs were kicking. The limbs were at war. The feet wanted back to earth, but the hands wouldn't release the rope. The noose was working perfectly. Arterial flow continued in the head and neck, bringing more blood from the heart. The veins, however, were completely compressed, leaving the blood no escape, building pressure on the brain. His head pounded with congestion like the worst sinus headache imaginable. The eyes bulged. His face flushed red. He could taste blood in his mouth as small bleeding sites erupted in the moist, soft mucosa of the lips and mouth. Then he felt it. The bizarre physiological result of muscle sphincters that spasm and relax uncontrollably. It was one of three known ways to achieve erection, even climax. Sleep, sex, and hangings. His eyes closed. All went black. The death grip was broken. The pulley squealed as the loosened rope raced around its wheel. His limp body plummeted to the floor, toppling the ladder. Instinctively, he rose to his knees and untied the noose. He coughed twice, gasping for air. His chest swelled and his skinny shoulders heaved involuntarily. Gradually, the blackness improved to fuzzy vision. He regained his focus.
"Hey, what the hell is going on out there?"
It was his father yelling from inside the house. He always yelled. It seemed like the last time they'd actually had a normal conversation in the same room together was sometime before his mother died, before her teenage son found her limp body twirling from the rafters in the attic of their old house.
"Nothing."
His voice squeaked. It wasn't from puberty.
"Break something and you get your ass beat."
His old man was spoiling the revelry, so he blocked him out of his mind as he rose to a hunched-over position with his hands on his knees, catching his breath. The feeling was better than any runner's high, any rush of endorphins. Had he been with a buddy, he would have skinned a high five. But his friends would never have understood. Better to let them believe the bruises on his neck really were hickeys. For the time being, this was an experience unto himself. He gathered up the rope and untied the knot. He had used it before. He would use it again. "Practice makes perfect," his mother used to say. He was definitely approaching perfection. Someday, he would be the one to show others the way. Because he had been there many times, and he knew the way back. Part 1. 14 years later. Chapter 1. The rain was a sign of good luck and happiness. Andrea Henning had heard that old wives' tale at least 30 times today. She wondered if Mr. Gallup had ever conducted a poll to find out if couples who married on sunny days actually had higher divorce rates than those who waded through puddles on their way to the altar. Not that it really mattered. Rain on this wedding had been a virtual certainty. It was, after all, late winter in Seattle. Andy, no one called her Andrea, wasn't bothered by the weather, or any of the things a bride typically worried about. Maybe it was her training as an FBI agent, or maybe it was her innate common sense. Whenever something couldn't be controlled, Andy just dealt with it, and it usually worked out. Her crash diet had been a disaster, but the dress still fit perfectly. The best man was an idiot, yet he'd somehow remembered the marriage license. And the old candlelit church had never looked better. Bouquets of white roses with lace and pink ribbons adorned each pew. A long white runner stretched down the center aisle from the vestibule to the altar. The crowd was spread evenly, left side and right, soothed by a gentle harp as the last of four bridesmaids walked down the aisle. Rain or not, it was the wedding her mother had always told her to dream of. Andy moved into the open double doorway in the rear of the church. The wedding consultant helped with a satin train behind her. In front, the silver-haired minister waited at the altar, flanked on his right by bridesmaids dressed in red velvet dresses. To his left stood three young groomsmen and Andy's handsome husband-to-be. Rick looked nervous, even from a distance. His steely blue eyes glistened. They were almost glazed, probably from all the drinking his friends had inflicted on him last night. The rented tuxedo seemed a little tight for his chest and shoulders, but maybe he was just taking deep breaths. He would have been far more at ease in blue jeans. So would have Andy. The sound of the harp faded away. The guests fell silent. All heads swiveled toward the back of the church. Andy took her father's arm. Though a half foot shorter than her, he was a pillar of strength, normally. At the moment, she could feel his hands trembling. "Ready?" he asked. She didn't reply. The time had come. The pipe organ blared. Andy cringed. She had explicitly instructed the organist not to play the traditional "Here Comes the Bride." Her meddlesome mother had struck again. Together, Andy and her father started down the aisle. A camera flashed in her face, then another. It was like staring into a strobe light. At this rate, she'd not only be filing a married couple's tax return this year, but she'd also have to mark the yes in that little box that asks, "Are you blind?" Andy focused on the burning candles on the altar as she continued down the aisle. Friends and relatives beamed as she passed. They made her feel beautiful, though all of her life she'd been told she was beautiful. She resembled neither of her adoptive parents, of course. She had the prominent cheekbones and raven black hair of the American Indian mother she never knew. The deep green eyes were presumably from an Anglo father. The result was striking, an exotic ancestral mix. Halfway down the aisle, Andy slowed the pace. Her nervous father was walking way too fast. His hand was sweating in hers. She squeezed it, then released. Finally, they stopped before the minister, standing side by side. The loud organ ceased abruptly. Butterflies fluttered in her stomach. The minister raised his hands, then lowered them, instructing the crowd to sit. A quiet shuffle filled the church as 200 guests lowered themselves into oak pews. When all was quiet, the minister raised his voice and asked, "Who gives this bride?" The question echoed against Gothic stone arches. Her father swallowed hard. "Her mother and I do." Andy could barely recognize the shaky voice. He lifted her veil and kissed her on the cheek. "I love you," she whispered. He couldn't speak. He turned and walked to the front pew, taking the seat beside his wife. Andy climbed the two marble steps. The groom reached for her hand. She turned away, however, and faced the guests. She drew a deep breath and spoke with self-assurance. "I know this is unorthodox, but before we get started, I want to thank some people." The guests seemed confused. Her parents looked at one another. Nobody moved. Andy continued. First, I want to thank my parents. Mom, Dad, I love you both very much. I want to thank Reverend Jenkins, who has known me since I was a gangly teenager and has been looking forward to this day probably more than anyone. I also want to thank each and every one of you for coming today. It means so much to have your friendship, your support. Her voice trailed off. She averted her eyes, then drew a deep breath and looked squarely at the clock in the back of the church. But most of all, she said, her voice shaking, I want to thank Linda, my lovely sister and maid of honor, she glared to her right, for sleeping with the groom last night. The crowd gasped. Andy whirled and hit the groom squarely in the chest with her bouquet. Anger and embarrassment rushed through her veins. She hiked her long white wedding dress and ran for the side exit. You son of a bitch! Her father cried, charging toward the groom. The best man jumped forward to restrain the old man, but knocked him flat in an accident that looked like a sucker punch. My back! He was groaning, sprawled on the tile floor. The best man towered over him, Mike Tyson versus Red Buttons. He pasted her father, someone shouted. It was like the cheap shot heard round the world, as a dozen other men leaped from their pews, some to help the fallen father of the bride, others to take up the attack. Rick's buddies came to the defense. Shouting led to shoving, and in a matter of seconds, a black-and-white pile of thrashing men in tuxedos was rolling toward the altar. A shrill scream rose above the uproar as the horrified maid of honor raced for the exit. Get her! Shouted the flower girl. The crowd scattered. Women screamed. Fists were flying. A groomsman was suddenly airborne, slamming into the lectern. People, please, shouted Reverend Jenkins. Not in the house of the Lord. Andy didn't stop running. She burst through the exit and headed down the hall. It sounded like a soccer stadium riot behind her. She hoped no one would follow. She needed to be alone. She ducked into an empty office and quickly locked the door. She was out of breath, shoulders heaving. Part of her felt like crying, but she fought back the emotions. He wasn't worth crying over. He wasn't worth marrying. A tear ran down her cheek. She quickly brushed it away. Just one tear, that much she would allow. As she leaned against the wall, her shoulder blade inadvertently hit the light switch behind her and cut off the light. The room went black. She smiled weakly, recalling her grandpa's dying words. Turn out the lights, the party's over, she repeated softly. The thin smile faded, and she was alone in the darkness. Chapter 2 Sundays were Gus Wheatley's favorite workday. Monday to Friday was always a nonstop chain of conference calls and meetings in and out of the law firm. Saturdays, too, brought only interruptions. Ambitious young lawyers would drop by his corner office to impress the managing partner, just to let him know they weren't spending the weekend on the tennis court. Sunday was his one day to crank up the stereo and clear his desk. For a workaholic, Gus was an impressive physical specimen. Due largely to the typical overdo-it fashion in which he had heeded a doctor's warnings about his family's history of heart disease. He usually jogged or cycled before sunrise. Conference calls were often handled on the treadmill in the small fitness room adjacent to his office. He rarely drank at business dinners or cocktail parties, preferring always to keep his mind sharp. His confident good looks commanded attention in any setting. At 41, he was the youngest lawyer ever to serve as managing partner of Preston & Coolidge, Seattle's premier law firm. He'd spent his entire legal career there, having passed up a Supreme Court clerkship after graduation from Stanford Law. For some, a year at the nation's highest court would have been the ultimate experience. For Gus, drafting appellate opinions was simply too academic. From his first day of law school, his goal had been to head up one of the nation's leading law firms. Preston and Coolidge allowed him to live his dream. Night and day. 7 days a week. The firm technically had a 5-member executive committee, but no one disputed that it was Gus who really ran things. the benign dictator who controlled the fate of 200 attorneys. Gus loved the control, though it took the skill of a consummate politician to build consensus among partners whose egos could barely fit inside the building. It took passion to run a law firm and still find time to schmooze new clients and even practice a little law. He did have help, of course. Two of the firm's best secretaries kept his life in order. Also at his disposal were two gophers, loyal young men who did everything from picking up clients at the airport to shining their boss's shoes. For more substantive matters, an international lawyer, Martha Goldstein, was his anointed managerial assistant. That was a rather unimpressive title for such a coveted position, as it was widely assumed that Gus was grooming Martha to replace him. It would be years before that would happen. In the meantime, she had the brains and charisma to impress clients when Gus couldn't be there, and she was handling an increasing number of intra-firm administrative matters Gus hated to deal with. It might have been borderline sexism, but it was still a fact that older male partners screamed less about their annual bonus when it was presented by an attractive 36-year-old woman. Gus tapped his pencil on the accounting summaries before him, keeping time with the music blaring from his stereo. Only Sinatra could add pizzazz to his obligatory review of the firm's $11 million in monthly billings. The speakers on his rosewood credenza were beginning to rattle. Too much New York, New York. He leaned back and lowered the volume. Care to order out for Chinese? The woman's voice in the doorway caught him by surprise. It was Martha. He checked his Rolex, not realizing it was dinner time. Yeah, sure, he said with a smile. Want a bill to your client or mine? She knew he was kidding. Martha had just lost a major international bank as a client after sending out a bill that included laundry service charges that one of her associates had slipped into the statement. It wasn't for money laundering. He'd actually sent his shirts to the hotel cleaners and billed the client. Not funny, Gus. The desk phone rang. He hit the speaker button. Hello?
Mr. Wheatley?
The woman replied. Yes?
This is Mrs. Volpe at the Youth Center.
Who?
I'm the instructor in the tumbling class for 6 to 8-year-olds. Your daughter participates every Sunday afternoon.
Oh, right, he said, knowing absolutely nothing about it. Morgan loves that tumbling.
Actually, she's still quite timid about it. That's not why I'm calling, though. She told me not to bother you at work, but she's been waiting on a ride home for over 2 hours. It's almost 6 o'clock. Everyone's gone. We're ready to close up.
Thank you for calling, but Morgan's mother takes care of the car rides.
Yes, she usually does, but no one has seen your wife all day. We can't reach her by phone.
Gus glanced at Martha, who could overhear the conversation on the speaker. She whispered,
"Just send a cab."
His eyes brightened as if Martha were a genius. Mrs. Volpe, if you can wait just a few more minutes, I'll send a taxi right over. There was a pause on the line.
I'm sorry, sir, but the only people who can pick up children under the age of 12 from the youth center are parents or designated chaperones whose photographs and signatures are on file with the front office. We don't send children home with strangers.
Oh, of course. He ran a hand through his hair, thinking. Are you sure you can't reach my wife?
I've been trying for 2 hours.
All right, he said with exasperation. I'll try to find her. One of us will be there as soon as we can.
He hung up, then quickly punched out his wife's cell phone number.
After 4 rings, he got the recorded message announcing that the customer was unavailable. Damn it, Beth. Turn your stupid phone on.
He looked at Martha, obviously annoyed.
I'll take a rain check on dinner. Looks like I have to go play chauffeur.
Where's Beth?
Who the hell knows?
She do this often? Just forget to pick up the kid?
He crossed the room and grabbed his overcoat from the hook behind the door. It's always some damn thing with her.
Sounds like she could use a good smack on the back of the legs.
Gus shot her a look.
Martha said,
just a figure of speech. I heard one of my British clients say the other day. Hopefully not about his wife.
Lighten up. I wasn't being literal.
Yeah, okay. I'll see you tomorrow. He headed down the hall. An electronic access card allowed him through the metal gate that secured the firm's dramatic three-story lobby on weekends. He punched the button on the panel to call for the elevator. It would take a minute or two for a car to reach the 49th floor. While waiting, he was thinking about Martha's comment. A crack like that was pretty awkward, given the state of his marriage. His 15 years with Beth had had its share of rumors and allegations. It just wasn't anything to joke about. Or maybe he was just more sensitive lately, more aware of how unsettled his own feelings still were. At times, it seemed a miracle he stayed married to Beth. Chapter 3. Gus and his daughter sat up watching the Lion King video. It was way past her Sunday night bedtime, but Gus thought he'd take her mind off her worries with extended television privileges. It didn't work.
When's Mommy coming home?
She must have asked that question every 15 minutes. Gus had come up with just about every excuse he could think of. Traffic, running late. By 10 o'clock, he was out of explanations. He put Morgan to bed, which was an ordeal. He read to her, sat with her, and finally crawled in bed with her. Anything to ease her mind. She was clearly sensing his own anxieties. Finally, she was asleep. He sank into the leather recliner and channel surfed with a TV remote, stopping on the local news. The usual review of weekend crime sent his mind adrift until the broadcast shifted to a late-breaking live report of a fatal traffic accident on I-5. A tangled mess of metal appeared on the screen, the remnants of two cars and a dump truck. He leaned forward, then relaxed. The victims were male, no women involved in the crash. He chided himself for getting his pulse up. Of course it wasn't Beth. Her car was still in the garage. That, however, was part of his confusion. He knew that she had dropped off Morgan at the youth center at 2 o'clock. Morgan had confirmed that much. Gus had gone over it with his daughter several times, but she just couldn't remember if Mommy had said she would be back at 4, or if she had said Daddy would pick her up. He racked his brain, trying to recall if Beth had told him she was going somewhere and had asked him to pick up Morgan. Maybe he had just forgotten about it. That had to be it. Over the past few months, they'd become the world's worst communicators. She'd probably mumbled something to him 3 days ago on his way out the door. Typical Beth. Gus rose from his chair and went to the kitchen. The breakfast nook in their hillside mansion was built like a hexagonal glass jewel box, its floor-to-ceiling windows taking in a 270-degree vista. The night view was his favorite. It was the only one he really knew. He was always gone before dawn, home after dusk. The Wheatleys lived north of downtown in the more upscale section of Magnolia, where new dream homes and magnificent century-old estates offered both city and water views. Glass and stone office towers lit up the skyline to the southeast. Tonight, as on many nights, the tops of the tallest buildings were cut off by low-hanging clouds. His own office sat right at the cloud line, a perpetually lighted cubicle in the sky. To the west was Puget Sound, the huge north-south finger of water that separated the port city of Seattle from the Kitsap and Olympic peninsulas. It took some imagination, but if you thought of northwest Washington as a big right-hand mitten, it was the thumb-like peninsulas and Olympic Mountains to the west that kept the Pacific Ocean from ravaging Puget Sound and Seattle to the east. The Sound was dark now, only some shipping lights visible. A few more twinkling signs of light dotted Bainbridge Island. Gus focused on the faintest light in the distance, somewhere in the night. Where the hell is Beth? He wondered. Monday morning was anything but routine. Gus had been up all night. At 6 a.m., he felt the programmed urge to make the usual spate of calls to his East Coast clients, all of whom were 3 hours ahead of him. The urge, however, was not compelling. It came as somewhat of a surprise, an affront to the priorities of a man consumed by his profession. But his heart and mind were elsewhere. Morgan would be awake in 30 minutes. She'd want to know where Mommy was. He wanted to know where her mommy was. Gus poured himself a cup of black coffee and sat alone at the kitchen table. The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Seattle Post-Intelligencer lay rolled up and unread on the counter. The rain pattered lightly against the kitchen window. The sun had not yet risen. A thick pre-dawn fog robbed him of any view out of the window. No moon, no stars, no downtown city lights. It was still early, but he needed some answers before his daughter woke. Since Morgan's birth, Beth had kept a list of phone numbers taped to the refrigerator, people to call in case of emergencies. He dialed the top number and braced himself for a battle. The fourth ring was followed by a raspy, "Hello?" "Carla, it's Gus. Sorry to wake you." She didn't reply. For a second, Gus thought she might hang up. Carla was his younger sister, but that was secondary. First and foremost, she was his wife's best friend. Growing up, they had never been close. Marrying Beth and effectively coming between her and her best friend had only made things worse. Whenever Beth had a complaint about Gus, Carla was on her side. Sometimes it seemed as though Carla was even leading the charge. Through it all, however, they had managed a level of civility. A low level. "It's 6:20, she said, groaning. "What do you want?" "I'm a little concerned about Beth." Her voice took on urgency. "What did you do to her?" The accusatory tone angered him. God only knew what Beth had been telling Carla. "I didn't do anything to her. Can you please just answer a simple question for me? When's the last time you talked to Beth?" "We went out for brunch yesterday. Why?" "Did she say she was going anywhere? Going away?" "You mean like a vacation?" "Anything at all. In town, out of town, it doesn't matter. The only thing she mentioned was that she had to take Morgan over to the youth center at 2. Why are you asking me all this?" He sighed, then said, "Beth dropped Morgan off, but she never picked her up. I had to get Morgan myself. Beth never came home last night. I don't know where she is." "She's not here with me, if that's what you're implying." "I wasn't implying anything. I'm just trying to locate my wife. Do you have any idea where she might be?" "No, but I can speculate." "Go right ahead. Has it occurred to you that perhaps Beth has finally seen the light and found the courage to leave you?" She sounded so smug, he wanted to tell her to go to hell. But he knew Carla's theory wasn't out of the question. "If that was the case, don't you think she could have found a better way to do it than to leave her 6-year-old daughter stranded at the youth center with no ride home? Does a reasonably intelligent woman do something like that?" "If she's confused enough, maybe she does. Beth was very unhappy. You have no idea how unhappy she was." "That doesn't explain everything. I've been through her closet, her drawers. All her clothes are still there. Her shoes, her photo albums and collectibles. Nothing seems to be missing. It just doesn't look like she was planning an escape. Even her car is still in the garage. She doesn't have to drive to leave you." "I've been making phone calls since 4 a.m. I've checked with every cab company in the city. None of them picked up Beth from our house yesterday. I've called every hotel between here and White Pass. No Beth Wheatley. I even called Highway Patrol to see if there were any accidents."
"Did you try SeaTac?"
"The airlines won't give out passenger information."
"There you go. She could be flying the friendly skies as we speak."
"I don't think so."
"Why not?"
"Come on, Carla. I know what's going on here. I've suspected for months."
"Suspected what?"
"She's seeing someone, isn't she?"
"Another man? No way. You've soured her on the species for life."
"Carla, be straight with me. If she spent the night with another man, that's between her and me. But if that's not the case, then something scary is going on, and I need to call the police so they can start looking for her. So tell me, and you better tell me the truth. Things haven't been good between me and Beth lately. But this is Morgan's mother we're talking about. Your niece."
"I honestly don't know what to tell you."
Stop covering for her.
He was louder than he'd intended. He drew a deep breath, but still spoke harshly.
This is serious. Does a woman leave her husband without a suitcase? Without a purse, a wallet, her driver's license? Without so much as a $50 withdrawal from our bank account? Don't make me drag in law enforcement if you know this boils down to another lover. But if we can agree she might be in trouble, it's time to call the cops. Which is it, Carla?
There was a pause on the line, as if she were trying to put aside the lifetime of anger she'd built up against her brother. Finally, she answered in a shaky voice.
I think you better call the police.
The response chilled him. He didn't say thank you. He didn't say goodbye. He just hung up the phone and dialed the police. Chapter 4. The Meany Science, Math, and Arts Academy let out at 3:30. 500 middle school students burst through the exits like escaped prisoners. Some headed for the playground until their ride arrived. Others went straight for the long line of yellow buses. Noisy groups of kids who lived close enough to walk home were escorted off the schoolyard by volunteer patrollers. Benny Martinez and his two sidekicks walked alone. Benny was big for a sixth grader, confident to the point of cockiness, a natural leader. As to whether he'd devote his talents to good use or gang life, the verdict was still out. He walked slowly down the sidewalk and away from the school, passing the crowded buses. He wore a flashy blue and gray NFL Seattle Seahawks athletic jacket. Once outside the school property, he clipped a chain dog leash to his oversized blue jeans, just for effect. Although his parents wouldn't allow the skinhead haircut that was a gang trademark, his hair was cropped as short as his scissors could possibly cut it.
Come on, Benny,
his buddy said. His voice shook with nervousness. He was clearly in a hurry.
Be cool.
Benny clutched his knapsack, which concealed a stolen football. Experience had taught him never to run when carrying stolen goods. Some 20% of his classmates had been suspended at some time during the school year. Benny had yet to be tagged for anything. Fools, all of them. Coolness was key. He smiled at the patrol woman on the corner as he and his two buddies crossed the street. His friends looked as if they were about to wet their pants. Benny muttered beneath his breath,
"Run, and I'll kill you both."
His friends slowed their pace. Past poundings from Benny had taught them to do exactly as he said. Benny seemed to glide across the street, not anxious in the least. His friends tagged along on either side of him, with Benny a half step ahead. They walked as a unit for several blocks until Benny signaled halt. They reached the entrance to Washington Park Arboretum, a 200-acre woodland northeast of downtown. A light breeze from Union Bay stirred the towering fir trees before them. The sun was just a fuzzy amber ball behind a patchy blanket of clouds. Benny unzipped his knapsack and removed the leather football. Only now did he allow himself a smile.
"Go long," he said.
His friends sprinted into the park. Benny waved, telling them to keep going. He heaved the football with all his strength. Wind aided, it nearly made it to his friends. They wrestled with each other and rolled in the grass to gain control of the bouncing ball. Benny ran to catch up with him. His friend pitched it back to him, rugby style. The threesome ran along the asphalt bicycle path, pitching the ball back and forth among them. The winding trail took them up and over a hill, deep into a lush green meadow. The impressive Japanese tea garden loomed ahead. The boys were more focused on the ball than the sights. The long run had them breathless, but no one wanted to be the sissy who stopped the game. Benny pitched a high one. His friend got a hand on it, but missed. The ball rolled down the hill into a heavily wooded area.
"Idiot!"
shouted Benny.
"Me? You threw it!"
They stood at the edge of the bike trail. The hillside dropped off at a steep 40-degree angle. The long pole pines were nearly 30 feet tall, and Douglas firs even taller. Yet the ravine was so deep that some of the treetops were at the boys' eye level. They could hear running water splashing against the rocks somewhere below, but the evergreens were too thick to actually see the creek.
Benny glared at his friend.
Go get it. No way.
Benny shoved him off the ledge. He rolled about 30 feet down the hillside before grabbing hold of a tree. Loose gravel continued down the hill. He looked up in fear, about ready to cry. Benny didn't flinch.
Get the ball, he said.
The other boy spoke up.
Just forget it. It was stolen anyway. You afraid?
Asked Benny.
No. Are you?
Benny's eyes narrowed.
If you get there before I do, you can keep the ball.
His pal smiled at the challenge. Quickly but carefully, they started sliding on their butts down the side of the hill. It was grassy at the top, making it easier to control the descent. But the mud near the bottom made the slide even faster. Too fast. They were bouncing, then tumbling out of control. Low-hanging branches slapped their faces. Mud was flying everywhere, into their shoes and up their shirts. The farther the descent, the darker it got. The sound of the creek grew louder, until finally they landed with a thud at the foot of the hill. Benny groaned. His friend groaned louder. They were only a few feet apart, but there was barely enough light for them to see one another.
Benny?
He shook his head, getting his bearings.
Yeah? What the heck is that? What?
His friend pointed.
That! Up there, behind you.
Benny turned. His eyes were slowly adjusting to the dimness. Something was in the tree, a good 20 feet overhead. He stared, trying to focus. Finally, he could see it. Turning. Twisting. His eyes widened. There was no mistaking it. A body was hanging at the end of a rope. The boys looked at each other, then screamed in unison as they ran the other way along the side of the creek. For a special agent in the FBI, it was hard to define a typical Monday. The Monday after a wedding like Andy's definitely was not typical. Andy had been in the FBI for 3 years, all in the Seattle field office. The Bureau wasn't exactly a lifelong dream of hers. It was more of a safe landing for a self-assured thrill-seeker who might well have courted the other side of the law, had Mr. and Mrs. Henning not adopted her at the age of 9 and channeled her energy in the right direction. She was a junior Olympic mogul skier, till her knee gave out, and a certified scuba diver by the time she was 16. She went away to college at the University of California, Santa Barbara, thinking she would build a life near the beach. To everyone's surprise, she chose a rather serious major, psychology. Her grades were good enough to get her into law school, and, yet another surprise, she went. But it wasn't until her final year that real inspiration struck. At a recruitment panel on alternative careers, she was mesmerized by a woman who had just returned from an investigation of a terrorist bombing. That had settled it. She would join the FBI. The decision had thrilled her father, himself a cop, who had introduced her to guns at an early age. During her training at the academy, she had become only the 20th woman in Bureau history to make the Possible Club, a 98% male honorary fraternity for agents who shoot perfect scores on one of the toughest firearms courses in law enforcement. Despite the distinction, she'd spent her first 6 months doing routine background checks on prospective federal employees. It was a career dead end, reserved for marginal agents or for someone like Andy, who simply looked young for her age and wasn't taken seriously. Fortunately, one of the supervisory special agents spotted her talent. Unmatched drive and a healthy spirit of adventure, he had written in her evaluation, tempered by serious brain power and exceptional technical skills. He got her assigned to the bank robbery squad, where she'd made a name for herself over the next 18 months. At 27, she still looked young. No one, however, had trouble taking her seriously anymore. At least, not before the wedding. Andy struggled to keep smiling throughout the day. It wasn't easy. Nobody said a word about the wedding, though a group of secretaries at the water cooler had giggled after she'd passed. Everyone knew about it, of course. Some of them had been there. One of them was sporting a black eye to prove it.
See you mañana, said Andy on her way to the elevator. The receptionist waved and buzzed her through the electronically secured door. It was early, around 4:30. Thanks to the canceled honeymoon, her calendar was completely clear, making it a stretch to fill her day with anything meaningful. She didn't feel like going straight home, another night alone. Nights were awfully long this time of year, even without a heartache. She headed a few blocks south from the Federal Building toward the historic Pioneer Square, the old downtown business district where quaint cobblestone streets and 19th-century brick buildings were home to trendy galleries, boutiques, and restaurants. Andy stopped at J&M Cafe, a popular saloon that boasted the most impressive wooden bar this side of San Francisco. It was her favorite place for nachos, the perfect sinful ending to the rabbit food diet she'd endured for the bikini she wouldn't wear on the Hawaiian honeymoon she'd never take. The bar was crowded and noisy as usual, but she felt alone. A steady stream of patrons brushed against her back as they squeezed past on the way to the restrooms. Halfway through her mound of gooey tortilla chips, she sensed someone standing close behind her. She glanced over her shoulder. A handsome black man was staring at the empty stool beside her. "Excuse me," he said, still looking at the stool, "but is this woman taken?" Andy raised an eyebrow. "That has to be the lamest pickup line I have ever heard." "Thank you." He pulled up the stool and extended his hand. "Bond's the name. B.J. Bond." She shook his hand. "What's the B.J. stand for?" "Bond James." "So your full name would be Bond James Bond." They lost it simultaneously, sharing a laugh as they let the charade go. "Isaac," she said playfully, "nice to know I can count on your goofball sense of humor to lift my spirits." He grinned widely, then caught the server's eye and ordered a cup of American coffee. Isaac Underwood was the assistant special agent in charge of the FBI's Seattle field office, or ASAC, the number two man in an office of 116 agents. He had been Andy's immediate supervisor for 18 months before the promotion. He settled into the stool and reached for a fully loaded nacho. "Pretty decadent dinner," he said with his mouth full. "Like they say, we didn't work our way to the top of the food chain to eat tofu." "Amen to that." The server brought his coffee. Isaac reached for the sugar. "So, kiddo, you doing okay?" "Yeah," she said, adding a quick nod for emphasis. "I am." His expression turned serious. "Andy, if there's anything you need, time off, even a transfer." She raised a hand, halting him. "I'm okay, really." He sipped his coffee. "If it's any consolation, I always thought that guy was a bit of a prick." "Now you tell me." "You didn't notice?" "He wasn't always that way. We were inseparable all through law school. Even talked about opening up a firm together. When I ditched the idea of practicing law and joined the FBI instead, I think he had it in his mind that the Bureau would eat me alive and that I'd quit before long. He definitely didn't think it would last 3 years."
"Plenty of people change their minds about marrying cops. Most of them just cancel the engagement." Andy lowered her eyes.
"In hindsight, I think he tried. We had a huge fight last week. From the day we got engaged, we always talked about raising a family. All of a sudden, he tells me no kids, so long as my job description includes bullet dodging."
"Sounds like you should have canceled."
"I know. My mother talked me into going through with it. She had me convinced we could work it out, that Rick was just bluffing. I guess he wasn't bluffing. Just wish he hadn't picked such a sleazy way to keep us both from making a terrible mistake. And now I really wish I hadn't turned it into a circus."
"I'm sorry, Andy."
"Thanks, but don't be. I just want to get back to normal as soon as possible."
"I'm glad you see it that way, because I've got an assignment for you."
"Isaac, how sweet. You arranged to have a bank rob just to take my mind off my personal problems."
"Not exactly." He smiled,
Then he was serious again. Victoria Santos is coming over from Quantico tomorrow morning. Andy didn't know Santos, but she certainly knew of her. Santos had taught the course on criminal psychology to Andy's class of cadets at the academy. More to her credit, she was a legend among criminal profilers in the FBI's elite investigative support unit. "What for?" asked Andy. Isaac glanced at the crowd of customers hovering around them. "Let's talk about this outside, all right?" They paid the bill, poured their coffee into paper go-cups, and stepped outside. The busy city street crackled with the sound of rush hour on wet pavement. A damp chill cut through their overcoats. The sun had set only minutes ago, but the temperature had dropped precipitously. Andy sipped her hot coffee. Isaac kept talking as they walked together down the wide, tree-lined sidewalk. "Local police have asked the FBI for assistance," he said. "They have some homicides that may be related, possibly a serial killer at work."
"How many victims so far?"
"Two that we're pretty sure of. A third was found today."
"What makes them think they're related?"
"The first two took place in different parts of town, about a week apart, but they were virtually identical."
"You mean the similarities are in the killer's M.O. or in the victim's characteristics?"
"Both. From the victimology standpoint, it's like one was a carbon copy of the other. Both were white males, both 51 years old, same color hair and eyes, both divorced. They even drove the same kind of vehicle, Ford pickups."
"How did they die?"
"Basically strangulation, but there was a lot of evidence of overkill. Multiple stab wounds, blunt trauma, even some burns."
"So we've got a serial killer who hates middle-aged white men?"
"Not exclusively. The third victim is a white female in her mid-30s. Some kids found her body this afternoon."
"Why do the police think her murder is connected to the men's?"
"She was strangled, for one thing. And like the others, her body showed significant signs of overkill. But the cops aren't sure there is a connection. That's why they called in the FBI. I'm not even sure the geniuses back at Quantico think it's a serial killer just yet. I presume that's why they're sending Santos from ISU as opposed to a profiler from CASCU." Andy nodded, though she wasn't entirely familiar with the FBI's division of labor between the Investigative Support Unit, which had pioneered criminal profiling, and the Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit, which was a more recent creation. They stopped at the corner near Andy's car.
"What do you want me to do?" she asked.
"I want you to be the local coordinator. Team up with Santos. Help her get whatever she needs while she's out here." Andy hesitated, surprised. "You know there's nothing I'd rather do than work side by side with Victoria Santos. But there are at least 15 other agents in the office who'd kill for this assignment." "You're the only one with a degree in psychology. These days, that's virtually a prerequisite for any agent who hopes to get a foothold with the ISU. Why waste this assignment on someone who has no chance of breaking in?"
"Isaac, I really do appreciate this.
But let me be straight with you. I don't want it if your decision is based on sympathy for what happened to me on Saturday. This isn't charity. It's just good timing. You're qualified. This is what you've always wanted to do, and you're available. Frankly, now that you canceled your honeymoon, you're the only agent in Seattle with a completely clear calendar for the next 2 weeks."
"I guess Rick did me a favor."
"Maybe he did us both a favor." For a split second, she thought maybe he was talking on a personal rather than professional level. Before she could even sort out her thoughts, he had popped open his briefcase and was handing her a file. "Here's a copy of the materials we sent to Santos. Police reports, autopsy protocols, crime scene photos. Everything she wanted from the first two homicides. Look it over tonight." The traffic light changed, allowing pedestrians to cross. Isaac stepped off the curb. Andy tucked the file under her arm and remained at the corner by her car. "Beyond that," he said, "just be in my office at 8 a.m. sharp and prepare to work your ass off." A cold rain started to fall. Andy popped her umbrella. "Need a ride to your car?"
"Nah, I'm just a half block away."
He turned. "Isaac, she said, stopping him. Thank you. The rain was falling harder. He gave her a mock salute and dashed across the street. Andy watched from the curb. Halfway across, he slipped on the wet pavement, then raised a fist triumphantly as he regained his balance with hardly a break in stride. B.J. Bond, she thought, smiling as she headed for her car. Chapter 5. The police weren't the help Gus had hoped they would be. To them, a 35-year-old woman in a rocky marriage who was missing less than 24 hours seemed a more likely candidate for an extramarital affair than foul play. They did let him fill out a missing persons report. Beyond that, Gus was pretty much on his own. He canceled his Monday appointments and spent the morning and most of the afternoon trying to reconstruct Beth's weekend. He called the credit card companies to see where she had charged things, then visited those stores and restaurants. It was privately embarrassing, but his most recent photograph of Beth was almost a year old. Things had gotten that bad between them. Even so, one of the assistant managers at Nordstrom's department store recognized her. She hadn't seen Beth in weeks. No one else could even place her. Around 3 o'clock, he got an emergency call from one of those ever-so-considerate clients who just wouldn't take family crisis for an answer. 2 minutes turned into 10, 10 to 35. Gus finally had to fake a dead battery in his cell phone to shake free. He spent the balance of the afternoon at home making phone calls. Beth kept an address directory on their computer. He scrolled down the list alphabetically, calling each entry, asking if they'd seen her. The process became mechanical after a while, and he lost track of time. He was phoning the P's when the doorbell rang. Gus answered it. Carla was standing in the doorway with a covered dish. I brought Morgan dinner. Before he could even invite her inside, she was heading for the kitchen. Gus followed. Okay if I eat some too? The ribbing didn't break the ice. He said, actually, Morgan's having dinner over at a friend's house. I've been making phone calls all day. I didn't want her around. Business never stops for you, does it? It wasn't business. I've been trying to find Beth. Oh, she said sheepishly. Her combativeness dropped a notch. Actually, so have I. Any luck? She laid her casserole on the counter and removed her gloves. No, but that doesn't mean anything. It hasn't been that long. Gus looked away, then back. Can I ask you something kind of personal? It depends. Just forget for a minute that you're my sister. Put on your hat as Beth's best friend. Okay. Lately, I can't really say I've seen the two of you together all that much. Sometimes best friends can be like sisters. Sometimes it's just a label. Were you and Beth close? She made a face as if the question were complicated. We were at one time. But not lately? We've been closer. There was no big blowout or anything. It's like I told you this morning, Beth has been really unhappy the last few months. She was pretty unapproachable. Gus nodded. That's what I'm finding out. I've been going down her address book, calling all her friends. I haven't talked to anyone who's seen her or even talked to her on the phone in the past 2 months. Maybe she was too embarrassed. Abused women often blame themselves. He turned away, exasperated. I never laid a hand on Beth. I don't know why she said that, other than to hurt me. Gus Wheatley, a victim? I don't think so. From what I saw of Beth lately, she was more likely to hurt herself than to hurt you. Their eyes locked, as if a light had just gone off. Each could tell exactly what the other was thinking. Gus said, you don't think. God, I hope not. The phone rang. Gus grabbed it on the second ring. Hello? Yes, this is he. He started to pace, listening intently. The eyes widened with concern, borderline panic. I can be there in 20 minutes, he said finally and hung up. Carla seemed on the verge of explosion. What? She asked with urgency. Police found a body in Washington Park Arboretum. Looks to be a woman in her mid-30s. She raised a hand to her mouth in horror. Is it...
Don't know. They want me to come down for an ID.
He swallowed hard, his voice cracking.
They think it could be Beth.
Like most FBI agents, Andy didn't often go to the medical examiner's office. Barring some connection to the federal government or some congressionally legislated federal offense, dead bodies were basically a matter of state and local jurisdiction. Locals frequently did call upon the FBI for assistance in certain areas of expertise. The FBI crime lab, for one. Criminal profiling, for another. Andy didn't need to be reminded, however, that the locals still ran the investigation, even after the FBI answered the call for assistance. Fortunately, Andy had wasted no time reviewing the case files Isaac Underwood had given her. She was completely up to speed when he telephoned after dinner to tell her she needed to get down to the medical examiner's office right away. The King County Medical Examiner's office was housed in the basement of the Harborview Medical Center. Andy arrived a little after 7. One of the office attendants took her straight to the main examination room. A detective from the Seattle Police Department met her outside the door. He was a heavy-set man with thinning brown hair and a broad, flat nose, like an ex-boxer. "Andy Henning," she said, introducing herself. He seemed taken aback, as if the Andy he was expecting was Andy, a man. "Dick Kessler," he said as they shook hands. His tone was uninspired, like the beige and white office in which they stood. "Isaac Underwood sends his regards." He didn't, really, but Andy could see from the immediate smile on Kessler's face that the mere mention of her boss's name was a sure icebreaker. Isaac had an excellent relationship with the Seattle Police Department. He had started his law enforcement career there.
"Good old Isaac," he said with a nostalgic smile. "What a kick it used to be watching that guy on the witness stand. Did you know he still holds the department record for the most cocky criminal defense lawyers chewed up and spit out?"
"That doesn't surprise me."
"Is he coming?"
"He sent me. He said he got a call saying you were doing an ID tonight on the latest body. The woman you thought might be connected to a serial killer. I was hoping I could talk you into putting it off until tomorrow morning, when our ISU profiler arrives from Quantico. She'll be on a jet tonight."
Kessler shook his head.
"Can't put it off. Wouldn't be fair to the family. Assuming we have the right family."
"Who's coming down to make the ID?"
"Gus Wheatley. Big shot lawyer downtown."
"I've heard of him. What's his relation to the victim?"
"He reported his wife missing this morning. Honestly, we didn't do much with it. Not until this body was discovered."
"What makes you think it's her?"
"Not much so far. Unidentified white female, mid-30s, brown hair, about 120 pounds. Could be her."
"No driver's license or other identification on the body, I presume?"
"No."
"Clothing match?"
"Uh-uh. Body was found nude."
"No other distinguishing physical characteristics?"
"We'll need Mr. Wheatley's help with that. It's hard for us to say at this point. Birds and critters have already eaten away a good bit of the flesh. She's a little taller than the height Mr. Wheatley reported for his wife, but the body could be somewhat elongated from hanging at the end of the rope."
The door opened to the examination room. Dr. Rudolph Fitzsimmons, chief pathologist, stood in the open doorway. He had very blonde hair, almost as white as his lab coat. The skin, too, was pasty, and he had seen more color in cadavers. Too much time down here in the basement, she surmised. He invited them in with a wave of his arm.